I guess my biggest takeaway, if we're going to start with the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, holy crap, Janet. Maybe you could pull this for one of our bump musics.
Damn it, Janet.
Yes!
Yeah.
Damn it, Janet. I love you.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome to the noon hour. Thank you for joining us on your lunch hour. We have a very special hour planned for you today. My former boss is here in person, George Stanley, former editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. How you doing?
Hey, Kristen. Good.
Welcome to our little studio in downtown Waukesha.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So it's been 2 months since
two months since my last day. Yeah.
How's it feeling?
Well, I'm still adjusting. People told me it would be an adjustment, and they were right. I didn't believe them at first, but they were right. So I have to develop my own new routine for getting things done, and I'm figuring that out, but I'm still going.
Are you sleeping in?
No, not really. Haven't figured that part out yet.
So do you consider yourself to be retired, or is this a transition right now?
Yeah, I think it's more of a transition to the next stage. And some people have already asked me to come do some work for them as advisor or consultant. And so I'll be working with the local news initiative at Northwestern University, which is really looking at where, because of the changing business models in news, are people losing independent fact-based reporting, which is essential to democracy, and then what are the best practices for replacing that and building, you know, making sure we don't have news deserts in our country.
And so that's a program at Northwestern. And so you'd be teaching, or is it research?
No, it's working with researchers to figure out where the news deserts are, where the next ones are going to be, map it all out so people can find it state by state, county, down to the county level. And then looking for trends and potential best practices, potential solutions, potential ways to get news back to the areas that don't have it anymore. There's more than a couple hundred counties in the United States that don't have a single newspaper anymore. Wow. In the whole county. And there's about 2,000 that only have one. And a lot of those are weeklies. And it's just, you know, there's a lot of research but that shows what happens when you don't have a newspaper covering your village board or city council or your school board meetings or all the other things that are going on in life. You know, corruption goes up, one party rule goes up. And eventually it's just essential to democracy itself that people are well informed to make good public policy decisions at the local level as well as state and federal level.
Well, I definitely want to get, that's a big chunk of what I want to talk about today, is both the how journalism and news has changed in your 43-year career, also kind of like what you think could help it. But before we do that, let's talk about your 43-year career. And so your entire career was in journalism, right?
Yep. I started out the Lake Geneva Regional News, a little weekly down in Lake Geneva. And then I worked for Ducks Unlimited magazine, which is a conservation organization. I became an environmental conservation writer when I was working for Ducks Unlimited. And then I worked at the Wichita Eagle in Kansas as an environmental conservation outdoor writer down there. And then I came back home to Wisconsin and worked as an environmental conservation kind of around the state writer for the Milwaukee Sentinel and reporter. And then eventually I became business editor at the Sentinel, business editor at Journal Sentinel, managing editor at the Journal Sentinel. And for the last, I've been managing editor or editor of the Journal Sentinel since 97. So that's a long time.
And so is there a part of you that now that you're not the editor, do you miss like reporting and writing? Do you want to get back into writing?
Yes, I do actually. It's funny you mentioned that, but yeah, I always loved reporting and writing. The thing I loved about that job too was you're constantly learning. You know, you're always out there meeting experts and out watching what they're doing and what they're learning, and then learning it well enough to tell it to somebody else, and then using your writing skills to do that to the best of your ability. And I just love doing that. I never really wanted to be in management.
And yet you were a very long time.
Right. Right. Plus, I never spent much time in the office when I was a reporter. I was almost always out of the office. So it was kind of funny when they asked me to be an editor. But then I got to leverage what I knew over a big team, and that was fun to see the rewards of that too. So I really did appreciate that. But I really I'm looking forward to doing some of my own writing again.
Is any of it going to be narrative? Are you going to write a novel?
I don't know. You never know. It's possible, but also there's some stories I see out there as an old conservation environmental writer that I think could be good stories too. So
that's an interesting jump. So you went from doing conservation to business editor.
Yeah, I also covered ag issues were part of my beat, and I also covered whatever beat I had, and this is true with a lot of reporters, whatever beat they have, if they kind of have a nose for it, they end up doing some investigative stories because they just find out about stuff, or people give them tips and they go down that and they find it. So with me, one of the last stories I did as a reporter, we found out that Kraft Cheese, which is a huge buyer of milk in America, had figured out a way to manipulate the National Cheese Exchange in Green Bay to lower milk prices. Now, that lowered the prices farmers were getting for their milk, and family farms were already struggling, especially in the early 90s. And again, that was a bad cycle for family farms. And so they were dumping cheese on this National Cheese Exchange in Green Bay, and because of a price-setting formula set up back in the Dust Bowl era in the 30s, it affected what farmers got paid everywhere except California and the United States. Mm. And so I'd done that story, and that led to the cheese exchange being closed down. And now it's a part of the futures market in Chicago, which is much harder to manipulate. So I guess they saw that as a business story. So
well, you can do this.
Yeah. And I had an older journalist who was 30 years older than me who wanted me to be the business editor. He was a business reporter, and he told me, you know, a good business story is just a good story, and you know what a good story is. And he was right, and it was very encouraging. So,
our guest is the former editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, George Stanley, is here with us on As Goes Wisconsin for the next hour. George, I have a silly question. I always imagine editors and managing editors as like Ed Asner, Lou Grant, cigar chewing, stompy, kind of, you know, scary, yelly people. Did you ever have to yell at your reporters? Because it just seems like you would have been the nicest yeller.
Yeah, I tried not to yell very often, and I tended to yell at my bosses more than the reporters.
Fair.
and I'd say that the amount of that had gone up in recent years. So, but I tried not to yell, but I think there may have been a couple of times when I did yell.
Did you yell more at reporters or kids?
At
at your kids.
Oh, my kids. Yeah, definitely my kids.
Because you have five kids,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, five kids. They're all grown up. Now I have seven grandkids. So
wow.
I don't yell at them at all. They're perfect.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So I guess as we round out this segment, because I definitely want to get into more stories in the next segment, but as you just were talking about the cheese exchange, what, and there's probably too many to name in an hour, but as far as the stories, whether you wrote them or you were the editor for them, or even the editor for the entire paper when they were written, what's one of the stories that comes to mind that you think moved the needle, that actually really changed how things were done?
Well, the one that I think of the most when it comes to that, because it actually saved babies' lives, was a big investigative report we did called Deadly Delays. And I think it was 2013 or 2014. And a doctor at Children's Hospital called Mark Johnson, a great health reporter of ours, because he had respected his work from the past. And he was distraught. I think he might have even had like a PTSD because he had just saved a 5-day-old newborn's life, and he wasn't sure he should have. He wasn't sure if the baby was going to be permanently brain damaged. The medical literature told him not to try to save his life because the ammonia levels were so high in his blood. But he did, and he was furious because he knew that that baby could have been treated with sugar water if his newborn screening test would have got to the state lab on time. So newborn screening tests, every single baby born in the United States has their heel pricked within 48 hours of birth, and the newborn screening test is supposed to be delivered immediately to the state lab and get back to a pediatrician and the doctors within 4 days, because that's when people's bad things can start happening if they have certain genetic disorders. This baby could have been treated with sugar water and released healthy from the hospital in 5 days, but his newborn screening test didn't get to the state lab on time. And because of that, he almost died. He was flown from central Wisconsin by Flight to Life to Children's Hospital, where they, you know, they did everything they could to save his life. The doctor was shouting into the phone at Mark, and he said, they're batching. They're all doing it. Somebody's got to stop it. You guys got to stop it. And Mark had never heard the term batching before. And he went to John Fauber, another health writer with great deal of experience. And he had never heard of it before either. So they started doing research. And they found out that state labs around the country had these warning signs, do not batch. And what it meant was that hospitals were holding on to newborn screening samples until they had enough that they thought it was cost effective to send them to the state lab rather than immediately getting them to the state lab. And then we got Ellen Gabler. She's now a reporter at the New York Times involved. She was a great data person. And she got data from about 36 states before we were done. And we found out that only one state was doing it the way it was supposed to be done, and that was Iowa. But the great thing about Iowa was it's a big state where there's a big distance between some hospitals and the state lab, and they managed to get everything done on time. So after that story came out, and we gave it away to other papers around the country, whoever wanted it. We weren't part of Gannett then, and we just gave it to everyone as a public service, especially in places where we found significant problems. And it changed overnight. It changed overnight. Yeah.
That's incredible. All right. Well, George Stanley is here with more stories about his 43 years in journalism. Stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
You are listening to As Goes Wisconsin, a product of Civic Media. Enjoy it live across Wisconsin, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Find your local station on our website, civicmedia.us, or on the Civic Media app, and catch any of your favorite shows as a podcast wherever you listen.
Kristen Bry, our guest this half hour is the whole hour is George Stanley, former editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And so I was tipped off by some of my colleagues over there to ask some other stories. So I heard you have a good Bart Starr story.
Well, growing up in Green Bay is a small city, very small city to have a professional sports team. And growing up during the Lombardi era, you know, you'd see Packers all over the place, Boy Scout banquets and church and everything. And when I was hitchhiking home from football practice in high school, and guy who stopped and picked me up was Bart Starr. He was coming back from football practice too. He was a player coach for the Packers at the time. And so, you know, I was a 14-year-old kid, and he had a 14-year-old son, I think, and some others, and so he understood, and he kept trying to make conversation, and I was just giving him my one-word answers.
Because you were just so shy?
Yeah, I was shy, and he was Bart Starr, and so we drove, and I knew where he lived. Everyone knew where he lived, and I still had another mile to go beyond that, and so as we get close to his turnoff, I could tell he wasn't slowing down. I said, well, you can drop me off here, Mr. Starr. And he said, no, that's okay. I'll take you home. It's right on my way. And then he drove, you know, a mile past his house and brought me to my house. And he waited till he gave me a little bit, very kind thing to be really careful about hitchhiking.
Cause okay.
You know, he gave me a little lesson, really nice. And then he watched me go into the house before he left, and then he turned back to go home. And then the funny part was about 2 or 3, 4 weeks later, he picked me up again hitchhiking home.
Really?
Yeah. And then he this time he knew where I lived already, and he told me he was right on his way, and he drove me home again.
Did he give you another
again,
speech about hitchhiking?
It wasn't a speech. It was just very kind. Just be careful when you're hitchhiking. And this funny part is I wrote about it, and after I wrote about it, I got dozens of other stories of people with very similar stories, including a woman who was a little bit younger than me who grew up in Green Bay. And she only hitchhiked once in her life. And she was coming back from Promontre High School in West Green Bay with her older brother. And her brother assured her they'd be safe and he'd watch out for her, but she didn't want to hitchhike. And she did. And of course they were safe because Bart Starr picked them up and drove them all the way home.
So this was a thing for him. Yeah. He liked picking kids up and be like, "Hey, let me help you out. But don't trust anyone else."
That's what he was doing. He saw you and he was going to get you home safe because he didn't know if the next person would. So that's what he was doing.
So as a season ticket holder,
yeah,
right. You inherited your family's tickets.
I did.
I've told you the story of that. My brother and I are fighting over who's going to inherit our tickets. I think I have claim because I live here.
Exactly.
Right?
He's older, but
I live here.
Yeah, but that trumps it. You're right.
Thank you.
The tickets.
Thank you for... I'm going to tell him that George family said so.
It's been decided now. It's done.
I'll tell my parents. That's even more.
You can let him go to one game if he wants.
Yeah, exactly. So as far... What's your favorite era of Packers?
Well, yeah. The Lombardi era.
Yeah.
Yeah. 5 championships in 7 years is pretty good. It's funny because I was like... 8, 9, and 10 when they won 3 in a row. And the New York Times did a big series, big story a few years ago. They were trying to figure out why people were such rabid Yankees or Mets fans, depending on what their age was and how it went by age. And so they did this data analysis and they found out that if you're a boy and your team wins a championship between the ages of 8 and 12, you're hopelessly addicted to that team for your entire life, no matter what. So it's heroin.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so how do we explain for the dark years of when they were so bad? There's still a lot of those guys it's still heroin for them, even though they lived through the bad times.
Oh yeah. There were some long bad years, but it's been good. It's been pretty good. I mean, it's better to win the whole thing, but it's been pretty good last 30, 40 years. But.
They've been very good. Almost my entire, life that I can remember because I would have been.
Yeah. My kids don't remember any bad teams.
Yeah. Like Brett Favre showed up pretty much when I was like a kid.
Yeah.
And we've been pretty good ever since.
Really good.
So it's hard to complain about that. But then I also heard you have a Chuck Yeager story.
Well, Chuck Yeager, before I left Ducks Unlimited, I found out that Chuck Yeager was an avid hunter, and I had arranged to go duck hunting with him out in California near where he lived. And when I switched jobs, so I did it for both the Wichita newspaper and for Ducks Unlimited, and got to know him. And I had gotten a tip from a guy who interviewed famous people before. He had just come out with his biography. Yeager was a bestseller, and it was out at that time, and The Right Stuff had already been out, the movie that really featured him. And this guy had interviewed a lot of famous people, and he told me, when you interview somebody that's been interviewed 1,000 times, you gotta know something that tells them that you really do know what you're talking about when it comes to them, because otherwise they're so used to answering the same questions that it just comes out like a robot and they're not even thinking. They're just giving you the same answer. They've given you the same question 100 times. So I found out there was an old biography of Chuck Yeager that had been written in the 50s, and only pilots had bought it because he was only known to pilots back then. And it was out of print, but they still had a copy of it in the Chicago library system. And I read it, And it was interesting because there were things in that much thinner biography that weren't in the much thicker best-selling autobiography, including the horrible nightmares he was having when all of his buddies were dying in the test pilot. And he was waking up with these horrendous nightmares. And as we were talking, at one point it came up in the conversation about the test flying days. And I said, do you still have the nightmares? And he told me, no, that he had decided one day that he couldn't survive if he kept having them. And so he just said, I can't have these anymore. And I said, I have to stop. And I did. And if you if you knew the guy, you could see that willpower, that he could actually do that. And he did. And so
I got to cut you off because we got to go to another break. That's a great story. So, all right, when we come back, we're going to finish the story.
Okay.
If there's more to tell. And then we're going to talk about the future of journalism as an industry.
Okay.
George Stanley is our guest. Stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Get heaven, sir, to sell the gospel news. Never mind, sir, how I look. Don't look at me and frown. I sell the morning paper, sir.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair. Our guest this whole hour is George Stanley, former editor of the Journal Sentinel. And so I want to have you finish because you told me the end of the story at the break. So I want everyone else to enjoy the end of the Chuck Yeager story when you got to interview him.
Oh, yeah. So I thought he had some really great life advice for everybody. He had been poor. He'd grown up poor in West Virginia and entered the Army as a private. Took advantage of a flying sergeant's program when they were desperately short of pilots and retired as a general after becoming the most famous and best respected pilot of all pilots. And he said, I really only did one thing in my whole life. He said, I did the best I knew how at the job I had that day. And that's all I ever did. And everything else worked out because of that.
That's very good advice. All right. Well, actually, this is a pretty good pivot. So someone left on the left a comment on the live stream that a lot of folks may not know that Journal Sentinel used to be one of the few employee-owned corporations in the U.S. in the 60s through the 90s. So that was when you were there.
We were the oldest employee-owned company in America. We were an employee-owned company before they invented the ESOP system. And it was done during a wave of mergers in newspapers. The first wave when Hearst was buying newspapers all over the country. The Journal's Lucius Neiman and Harry Grant, who owned the Journal stock, when Neiman decided to retire, decided to protect the Journal from being bought up by a major chain by making it employee-owned. And it was a wonderful, wonderful system for employees until we went public in the early 2000s, which is probably the worst time for a newspaper media company to go public. You know, historically, you couldn't have picked a worse time to do that.
And so I guess that's kind of a good pivot into how things have changed as far as you've seen a lot of different owners, ownership styles. And as far as like, do you feel like things are going in the right direction?
I think the journalists are still committed to being independent, fact-based, truth-seeking, and doing some of the best work we've ever done. I think, like, for example, in the last year with our Wires and Fires investigation and our landlord and the tenant stories, you know, you just can't do better journalism than that. But I do think that the business model has been just thrown upside down, like it has in a lot of industries. And it's when you think of it, so 40% of the Journal Sentinel's revenue came from classified ads in 1999, which was their record year for revenue. That's almost all vanished to online with Craigslist and everything else. It didn't exist in 1999, at least in Milwaukee. And then the two biggest advertisers in the Journal Sentinel back then were the Boston store and American TV, neither of which exist anymore. And when you think of what Amazon and buying things online, having it shipped to your house, what that's done to local retailing all over the country, and the local retailers were the advertising, that that supported local news. So it's been a huge, huge shift, and digital circulation has helped a lot with providing revenue. But it's we really still have to find the solution because we need local news to have democracy. You know, that's why it's the First Amendment. If the people aren't well informed and don't know what's going on, we're not going to have good public policy. We're not going to have elect the right people, and it's going to be too easy to manipulate things and get away with it. So people just need to support, I think, local news as much if they care about those things, because we got to keep it alive.
Because we're very honest as far as like what I do here, even what I do as with my videos at Journal Sentinel is I couldn't do what I do, which is editorialize, summarize the news without journalists, right? Like
right.
I'm not the one going through the city budget and
right.
looking line item by line item. And I think people I don't know if the average person understands the painstaking, tedious work that some of this investigative reporting actually is, that the meetings you have to sit at, the budget and the documents
the records,
you have to go through.
Yeah.
And for a lot of us, would especially those of us with ADHD, would be like, nah, I'm good, man. and so it is. It's so important. But it's as far as the different, there's subscription and membership models. There's independent journalists doing like Patreon, where it's just people who want to support them. There is still advertising. Then there's also just having a very rich person own your company, like Jeff Bezos. And so...
Right.
What do you feel like as you, whether it's at Northwestern and as you're starting to explore this, what do you feel like is for local journalism, maybe not for the national outlets, but feels like a good model or a good way forward?
Right now, the ones that are doing the best are the ones that are locally owned by a civic-minded owner. So if it's in a metropolitan city like Milwaukee, The ones that are doing the best right now as finding the future are the Boston Globe, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the Seattle Times, the Tampa Bay Times, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, the Charleston Post and Courier down in South Carolina. All of those are privately owned. They're not on the stock market. And so they can put up with the ups and downs. All of them are demanding, the Philadelphia Inquirer, which is owned by a foundation, they're all demanding that they don't lose money. They're all demanding that the news organizations don't lose money, but they're not demanding double-digit profits to
please
investors.
So that they can buy a second house?
Yeah, so that they, whatever, you know. And the problem with this publicly traded stock markets is really when you're an industry that's in transition, that's not growing, you're there to be picked apart or, you know, to be sold for the pieces, because stock market's a great place to be if you're trying to raise money to build up something new. That's a great place to be if you're like what we used to be, so solid you can pay a big, strong dividend every quarter no matter what. It's a terrible place to be when you're in a transition and you're shrinking and trying to find the future because people are going to tear you to pieces. So that's what's happening to the publicly traded companies.
Our guest is George Stanley. He is the former Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editor, and he is with us for the entire hour. If you have a question for George, you can call or text at 844-967-2789. George, we were talking a little bit earlier about the importance of having local journalists to cover school boards and budgets and to keep an eye on corruption. And as I understand it, when a community loses its local coverage, it can actually affect its bond rating because nobody is watching that stuff.
That's exactly right. And anyone who's done this kind of reporting and knows that you're the only person at that meeting that's keeping an eye on things knows that as soon as people stop being watched, not everybody, but bad things start to happen here and there. And it's the other thing that the reporters are is the outlet. So I don't think people realize, unless they've been in the middle of this kind of stuff, of how the sausage is made in government and everything else. I don't think people realize how much we depend on good people of goodwill in all our departments and agencies and companies to keep things honest. And
like people who are willing to give tips on like, this is what's going
people
on?
People who, when they see something bad, first, almost every time, almost every whistleblower, every person we've talked to has been a great source on a story. Almost every time they've tried to fix it within their company or their agency first, and they've been stiff-armed or worse, punished for trying to point out that this is wrong. So what happens is the reporter that comes to that agency's meetings or that commission's meetings or whatever, or that reports about that industry, that person notices and says, well, maybe I can get the word out to them and they can tell the people what's going on. And that's when things get exposed, problems get exposed so that they can be fixed. And until that happens, things never get fixed. It's just the way we fix things in a democracy. And I think the only places where things do get fixed are in democracies because otherwise the public doesn't know what's going on and they can't demand better. You can't demand better if you don't know what's going on. Every single case, it's a person of goodwill who knows that this is wrong, that's letting us know. Great example. Raquel Rutledge did a fantastic investigative series, won the Pulitzer Prize for cashing in on kids 10 years ago, saved taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars in fraud. A person within the state government had tried to solve that problem, seeing massive fraud in subsidized child care, and had been ignored and even punished, and came as an anonymous tipster, led us to the story after a child died in a van, related to the whole story, led to this massive story and massive hundreds of people ended up being arrested. People were using this money to have indoor pools and basketball courts for their child care, you know, off of their
like
child
Brett
care.
Brett Favre before Brett Favre.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. But we needed that tip to know what was happening. And she tried to fix it. He or she tried to fix it within before coming to us.
George, I remember that story so well and just the bombshell that it exposed. And again, for folks who think, yeah, we don't need a paper, you really need a newspaper.
And I guess, you know, I think it's so interesting being able to be in the newsroom myself. And like you said, there's such good journalism and there's such good work being done. And then like both things can be true, that as a standalone newspaper and the people who work there, and separating that from the criticisms of the company, of Gannett, right? And so as far as when Gannett took over, was there any, to take away the obvious criticisms, was there any benefit of being part of such a big company?
Yeah, there actually was. We went through a couple ownership changes. So first we were employee-owned, then we went public. And when we went public, that was not a good thing for us at the newspaper. And we were being run by the broadcast division, and they didn't see the future in the newspaper either. So our worst cuts were actually in 2008, 2009, and then we were sold in 2014 to Scripps, and then spun off into Journal Media Group away from the broadcast. And then 1 year after that, we were sold to Gannett. And then Gannett was bought by Gatehouse 3 years ago. So you can see what's happening.
Yeah.
And Gannett brought a lot of advantages, actually. First of all, they had some really good journalists. And I was very impressed, having never worked for them before, how we could speak the same language and they would support our investigative work and the good work we were doing. And having a national outlet was very helpful. So if we would have done Deadly Delays then, we could have got the word out even broader, faster about the newborn screening, for example. So when we did have those stories, that was really good to have. And there were other really good things too. Right now, they've got to find that. And there's still really good journalists in Gannett, and there's really good journalists at the Journal Sentinel. So I think we've just got to find that footing so that we went through 2021, we didn't have any cuts. Mm-hmm. And then last year we did. So if we can get back to where we're not cutting anymore and then start rebuilding, that would be fantastic.
All right. Well, we'll take one more break, but George Stanley will still be here when we come back. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
When wars were started or when they ended, we
a much better world to live in, but the question would be whose and what side you're on, or who's right or wrong. You never have to choose. Sometimes late at night I can see the streets like no one else can. There's a lot of things going on here that even newspapers don't understand. Some people got too much money, some robbed with a gun or a ballpoint pen. Maybe I'll get me a big black cape and then they'll be running from me, looking over their shoulder for me. What's buried in the back pages was on the front just yesterday. And old news never dies, though they say it just fades away. Crime and murder, business and politics, and international strife, it's all the same, find someone to blame.
Paperman meets such interesting people, they know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And we have been talking to George Stanley, the former editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And you were mentioning some of the times, multiple times, Milwaukee Journal Sentinels won a Pulitzer Prize. And I think one of the coolest, there's a lot of cool things in the newsroom, one of which is the bench that John F. Kennedy sat on. But there's also the framed front pages of times that Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has won a Pulitzer. And I think, is it three or four of those pictures that you're in the background, arms raised, when the picture was snapped and the announcement was made? And so what was that like as far as, I mean, either was it one of those times or another time as far as the proudest moments of your career there as far as what the paper was able to accomplish?
Those were really fun, and what I love about those was it's the recognition that the reporters and the teams get, which is career-building recognition for them, which is wonderful, because they have to work so hard on those projects. I mean, it's really a grind, and it's very, very hard work. So it's great to see that, but the things that have brought me the most joy through work have been when you actually see the impact and people's lives being improved. So when we did series after series till it finally accomplished something, but finally, you know, bipartisan legislation and other action taken to fix county mental health care and build 6 new apartment buildings for people that were living in squalor because of the horrible conditions that we exposed before that, for people with illnesses that affected their minds and weren't being treated with any decency whatsoever. So when you see those types of impacts, that's what really, when you see that actually happen, you can see the building and the people living with a nurse there, making sure their meds are working and they're living decent lives. That makes you much more happier than, I think, winning an award.
Do you, in the 2 months, do you miss it?
I miss the people, you know, and I miss just having conversations in the newsroom with my friends and colleagues, and that way that you know, one thing leads to another when you're having those conversations. That's what I miss the most.
What don't you miss?
I don't miss anything to do with budgets.
Okay.
Or Zoom meetings. And I don't miss my email.
Fair. Very fair. All right. Well, one of the burning questions that I was told to ask, who's your favorite trending sports reporter?
Oh, yes. I saw that question asked by far the best trending sports reporter in America, J.R. Radcliffe.
Friend of the show. Regular on this show. And so I felt like I owed
no
it to
comparison.
Him to ask. No comparison.
No.
And then I feel like I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask, who do you want to take your place? Because they have not announced that yet.
They haven't. We have a great leadership team that I'm very proud of, and I think it can. I think they could lead any newsroom in the country. I'm very confident that they're going to select the next editor from within, and I'm very confident that it's going to be a great journalist who really understands Milwaukee, knows Milwaukee, and that the whole leadership team is going to remain intact and knows Wisconsin, and that they're going to be people who care, who have been here, and who really know how to do great journalism.
That's good. So you think it's going to be someone here instead of
definitely
outsider coming in trying to learn the area?
Yep, and I think it's going to be someone really good who I've been, you know, I just think the newsroom's been terrific since I left. I'm not sure people miss me very much.
So. We've had some pretty, I would say, you know, I split time here and there, but as far as going in there, I read it. I'm not kidding. When I, as someone who now does this part, I was already reading it all the time, mm-hmm. trying to pick out what story.
That's how
I
we
wanted.
Found you. You were doing great versions of our stories.
Exactly. And so it was like, I still, but now I really, it's like, all right, I got filled 3 hours of time. And so it is, the reporting that happens there is so good. And you're right that it hasn't missed a beat, even though you are definitely missed. And so as far as on an ending note, either advice for your predecessor who has not been named yet, or advice for anyone who's still working there, what are your parting words, even though you're not really, you're still
around? Yeah, just what I've told people all along through all the changes is just keep doing the Chuck Yeager thing. Just keep coming in every day, doing the best you know how at the job you have today. What's the best story we could be working on today that'll improve lives, that'll affect people, that are important to people that they need to know? Just focus on that and don't worry about all the other stuff.
George, anything on your bucket list now that you don't have to go in any every day and go through the grind?
That's a really good question. And I my wife and I do want to do more traveling. And I think we will be doing some more traveling now, and including places like Hawaii and Alaska, which we've never been to, and some other parts of the world that we haven't been to.
So traveling.
That'll be part of it, yeah.
Okay. Maybe write a novel.
You'll find out if I do.
Maybe save journalism.
Maybe save journalism. That's way up high on the list. Saving journalism for democracy.
Exactly. Any predictions on the future of Wisconsin?
I'm feeling better about because I'm meeting people that are working to make civil discussion and bring it back to politics, and I'm feeling a lot better that this phase toward getting worse and worse and more polarized, and this hatred of is hopefully more and more people are getting sick of it and saying, let's bring reason and civility back to our government and to our politics. And I hope that, I think voters can demand that, and that's what it's going to take. I think the citizens have to say, we want you to focus on the things that are really important and not make up issues and not try to rile people up on social media. And we're sick of the BS and we just want to go forward. Do I have time to expound on that a little at all?
You got 1 minute.
Okay. So this Gableman investigation last year.
That guy.
When I was a reporter 30 years ago, the first story we did showing what a farce that investigation was and what a waste of taxpayer dollars, it would have been eliminated. If it was done by Democrats or Republicans, didn't matter. The party would have been embarrassed. They would have pulled the plug. It would have been done. We did a year's worth of stories. $1 million was spent and wasted, and nothing happened.
Up to two now.
And that bothers me. And to me, that's a call out to the citizens of Wisconsin to say, enough of this stuff. Spend our tax dollars helping us and on efficient, good government and not on your BS.
That's a really good point. It's a great point to end on. George Stanley, thank you for spending an hour with us today. This was lovely.
Hey, thanks a lot, Kristen.
All right. Thanks, well, Jane. When we come back, the No Sour, Happy, Fun Time, Ha Ha Power Hour. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Robotic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers.
Thank you for listening to As Goes Wisconsin, available on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave us a rating. As Goes Wisconsin is a product of Civic Media and airs live across Wisconsin Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Civic Media is a statewide network of radio stations broadcasting local news, local sports, thoughtful commentary, and hand-picked music. We are always streaming on the Civic Media app. Find out where you can listen on the air or learn more about Civic Media and sponsorship opportunities by going to our website, civicmedia.us. We thank you for listening.